Today on the 21st Show, hundreds of rural hospitals across the country have closed over the past few decades, while others have had to change what they offer to stay open. We'll talk about where hospitals in Illinois stand and what changes to Medicare and Medicaid will mean for the future of rural healthcare and the areas those hospitals serve. You can share your thoughts throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. What questions do you have about rural hospitals and what the future holds for them? Do you rely on rural hospitals for your own care? That's 800-222-9455. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL Urbana, WUIS Springfield, WGLT Normal, WNIJ Rockford DeKalb, WVIK Quad Cities, and WSIU Carbondale. First, the news. Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, in this week for Brian Mackey. Rural hospitals provide health care to thousands of people across Illinois, people who live in rural areas but either don't want to or can't drive to a major city to get that care. But rural hospitals have been struggling for decades. Hundreds have closed, and the ones that haven't face challenges from low patient numbers to low reimbursements from Medicaid and Medicare, the programs that give many rural residents access to care. And now, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act that President Trump signed into law last month is making substantial changes to those programs. Medicaid spending alone will come down by more than $1 trillion over the next decade. And that could cause millions of people to lose their health insurance. Many people in the world of healthcare have sounded off on this when Democratic Congressman and Senate candidate Raja Krishnamoorthy toured Franklin Hospital in Benton in southern Illinois last Tuesday. Hospital CEO Jim Johnson had this to say.
We're not going to close, you know, against the common or what was put out recently. We're here to stay. And our financial track record bears that out.
For rural hospitals, all this raises a lot of questions about what the future holds, and that's the topic for today's show, the state of rural hospitals across Illinois and beyond. Joining me now to talk about this is Tracy Warner, Executive Director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network, ICANN for short, an organization focused on rural hospital collaboration. Tracy, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be part of the show.
And Ted Rogalski is administrator for two rural hospitals, Mercy One Genesis Aledo Medical Center in Mercer County near the Quad Cities, and Mercy One Genesis DeWitt Medical Center in Iowa. Ted, welcome to you as well. Thanks so much for being with us.
And good morning. Glad to have you.
Listeners, you can join the conversation throughout the hour. Our number is 800-222-9455. What questions do you have about how rural hospitals are doing and what the future holds for them? And do you yourself rely on rural hospitals for your care? Are you worried about being able to access that care? Our number, 800-222-9455. Tracy, let's start with you, kind of big picture here. What role do rural hospitals play in the communities they serve, especially in terms of providing the care that people need?
Certainly. Rural hospitals are a huge part of their rural communities, often the largest employer in the state, in the community. So not only providing access to healthcare locally so that patients and community residents don't have to travel far outside of an immediate area where they live to get some of their needed healthcare services, but also the community benefit and also the economic impact that rural hospitals provide to their communities. The numbers are pretty big. Of 86 rural hospitals in Illinois, they employ 72,000 people, and that contributes $16 billion annually to the local and state economy. So very clear that they provide not only access to the health and to are indispensable by providing access to health and contributing to the well-being of their communities. They also reduce that strain of travel and support the local economy in their communities.
And can you talk about the scale of what these hospitals provide? A particular rural hospital might be in one rural community, but they also serve a broader region, most of these hospitals that are spread across this state. Is that correct?
Yeah, some of them do. Some are larger than others, as you can imagine, as with urban hospitals that have a larger footprint than others. But many times the local community hospital will have a clinic, your primary care physician, for example, that you can see at the local hospital or the local clinic. But there are a number of our rural hospitals that have clinics in neighboring communities. In their kind of county or region that allow access to primary health care in those communities without having to drive into a hospital that actually has a community. So there are a number of hospitals that their footprint obviously stretches beyond just those four walls or the campus of the hospital in a particular community because they have those services in some of the other neighboring communities that are providing closer access than coming to a community that actually has a hospital in it.
And Ted, as an administrator for a couple of these rural hospitals, what else would you add about what rural hospitals bring to their communities, perhaps even beyond medical care?
Yeah, well, and I think Tracy pointed it out earlier in her comments, is the economic impact that our hospitals have. Typically, we're either, you know, probably in the top three employers in our communities, sometimes number one. And so the economic impact that we bring with the wages and the spending of, you know, purchasing supplies and capital investment is really great to the economic viability of our rural communities.
And tell us a little bit about your part of the state, and you're on the border of Illinois and Iowa, and a little bit about the hospitals that you oversee.
Yeah, I'll focus pretty much on our Aledo facility, which is in Mercer County. It's one of our smaller counties in the state. We serve a population of about 16,000 people. It's very, farm driven is the biggest employer, if you will, in our community. But I came down to Aledo about 13 years ago, and it was really a turnaround effort. It was a county hospital at the time, and they were not doing well financially. And they decided to affiliate with a Genesis Health System out of the Quad Cities. And so we worked on that for a couple of years. We're able to turn things around financially. And then we did acquire that facility. And so now it is part of a larger system. 2.5 years ago, we joined Mercy One, which is a regional health ministry of Trinity Health out of Michigan. So we've been through integration a couple of times, and the hospital's been very successful over that 13-year period of time.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, and we're talking for the hour today about the state of rural hospitals in Illinois, especially in the wake of Congress passing the One Big Beautiful Bill Act in July, which makes substantial changes to Medicare and Medicaid. We're talking about what all of this means with Ted Rogalski with Mercy One Genesis Aledo Medical Center and Mercy One Genesis DeWitt Medical Center, and Tracy Warner with the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. And I'd like to bring another guest into our conversation today. Melanie Evans is reporter and producer for the nonprofit health policy-focused news organization Trade-Offs. She's reported on the upcoming Medicaid and Medicare cuts. Melanie, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you help put all this into context for us, Melanie? What are some of the bigger trends we've seen with rural hospitals across the country in recent years?
Well, you mentioned earlier the trends in closures. So in the last 20 years or so, about 112 rural hospitals have closed completely. And this is according to tracking by the University of North Carolina Shepps Center. And then you've got another 84 that just stopped admitting patients who are acutely ill. So they can't put a patient in a bed with doctors and nurses to monitor them around the clock. And so when you look at why that's happening, Shepps basically says it's you're looking at profit and how much cash hospitals have on hand as these really important predictors of financial distress. And so one of the concerns and questions that's sort of dogging the reconciliation package that just came out of Congress is, what will these very substantial changes that are projected for Medicaid spending mean for distressed hospitals? How much additional financial stress will it add? And then can they withstand that stress? And there is some analysis from researchers that suggest hospitals will close. So a recent publication out of JAMA said about maybe at least 100 hospitals might close. SHEPS identified about 340 hospitals that are risk, including at risk, including 9 in Illinois. And I believe the CEO from Franklin, who was quoted at the beginning of the show, was kind of addressing the fact that Franklin Hospital is one of those hospitals on the list.
I want to share with you a text we got. Listeners, you can join by texting the word TALK, that's TALK, to 217-803-0730. Virginia in Springfield wrote to us to say, adequate funding for all hospitals throughout the USA is a critically important topic in 2025. This social concern is absolutely not a new social concern, however. In the 1980s, I worked as a librarian at the American Hospital Association, and every week I located articles and books on this topic. The question of how to best fund rural hospitals also has been discussed for decades. The recent Trump administration cuts add to the crisis, but they did not cause the current challenges. Thanks for that text, Virginia. Melanie, I wonder if you can speak to that. How have the latest developments worsened the situation that has been kind of ongoing for quite some time?
Sure. So what we can do is we can sort of look at where this new reconciliation package is going to change the money, you know, flowing from, you know, states and the federal government to rural hospitals. And I'm sure both Tracy and Ted can speak to this with a lot more specificity than I can, but I'll say big picture, the big beautiful bill, as it's called, or OB3, or the reconciliation package. I've heard different people use different terminology for the bill. What it does is it changes and in some ways restricts the way that hospitals have used some taxes, provider taxes, to help finance their Medicaid program. And then it puts some real limits on how states pay hospitals. That sort of like combined effect reduces the amount of money, you know, flowing into the Medicaid program that can be used, you know, to pay for patients' care. Oh, go ahead, please.
Oh, I was going to say, I want to squeeze in a caller here before we have to go to a break, because we've got a caller on the line. 800-222-9455 is the number if you'd like to join us. And we've got Dave calling in from Princeton, Illinois, with some questions. Dave, go ahead with your question.
Yes, my concern is that our rural hospitals are either closing down because of private equity firms, or their services are being scaled back to where they're nothing more than glorified first aid stations, to where they patch you up and ship you off to a larger hospital. My daughter is a nurse, and she had to change her job area 3 times because of closures. Now she works in a doctor's office. And, you know, years ago, they used to talk about the golden hour, you know, for patients having a stroke or a heart attack. Well, that golden hour now is being eaten up in travel time to the larger hospitals. So it's a bit scary. I'm getting elderly myself. And it's a bit scary that, you know, am I going to make it to the larger hospital?
Yeah. Thanks for that call, Dave, and for your question. And Tracy Warner, you lead the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. I wonder if you could speak to those concerns. I imagine that's a pretty common concern for anyone who lives in a rural area or is thinking of moving to a rural area. If the hospital's at risk of closure, or even if it's not at risk of closure, but if it's at risk of losing critical care services and they'd have to travel, like Dave mentioned, if they're having a stroke, what are your thoughts on that? How would you respond?
Sure, and I definitely appreciate Dave's concerns, having worked with rural hospitals for virtually my entire career. So even the previous Text that you referenced about this is not a new problem for hospitals and healthcare in general, but for my entire career, the last 30 years or so, we've been dealing with reduced reimbursements and just increasing challenges with rising costs associated with staff and technology, of course, is one. The amount of technology and the expense associated with that rural hospitals need to acquire and have available for quality patient care. But in terms of the closures and the limitation on services, I would just say that so much, and especially the limitation on services, is related to the cost of those services and the lower volumes at rural hospitals that we just can't, we simply don't have the capacity in terms of the number of patients, but also the number of specialists, for example, that may need to be providing care across a community, including a rural hospital, simply aren't there. If you're talking about a urologist, for example, may be a common one that there just simply aren't enough urologists and there's not enough work in that rural hospital or that community for a urologist to be at that community hospital seeing patients 5 days a week. So many times they will have visiting specialists, cardiologists, urologists that will come out from an urban area to a rural hospital to have a clinic to have those services available in a closer proximity than having to drive to a larger community. So while you are seeing some of the limitation of the services, our rural hospitals have been very creative with technology like telehealth and trying to get folks access to those services in the rural communities.
And we're hoping to get into more creative solutions and what the future holds for the rest of the hour on the show. We're coming up on a short break. When we come back, we'll get a bit more into this topic on what the future looks like for rural hospitals in Illinois. 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Support for the 21st Show comes from listeners like you and the Des Moines Arts Center, located in Iowa's capital city, featuring works by regional, national, and international artists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Details are at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
First show, I'm Christine Herman. Our topic for the hour is rural hospitals, how they're doing, what's changed over the past few decades, and what they offer to the communities they serve. We're talking about this topic in the wake of cuts to Medicaid and Medicare passed by Congress last month because as we're about to get into, those will have pretty significant effects on these hospitals. We'll come back to our other guests in a few minutes here, but first I'd like to bring one more person into this conversation. Vicki Wiedenbacher-Hooper is Associate Director of the Rural Health Workforce and Center Development at the National Center for Rural Health Professions at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Rockford. Vicki, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can join the conversation throughout the rest of the hour at 800-222-9455 if you have a question for one of our guests. That's 800-222-9455. Vicki, we heard our prior guest mention the importance of rural hospitals in terms of the work and employment opportunities they provide for people in their communities. Talk to us about interest in working in rural health care. How has that changed over the time? How has that changed over time?
Yeah, so at the National Center for Rural Health Professions, we provide community-based rural healthcare education and training in preparing our medical students for rural practice. So we've actually went from having 15 slots per year to 25 slots per year, meaning that we accept 25 medical students who have declared an interest in practicing in rural areas. So there is an interest. I think there's some misconceptions out there about maybe lower salary. In some cases, that's true, but in other cases, that is not the case. The salary is competitive, especially when you look at cost of living in a rural area. The other thing that we've seen is we've had rural hospitals recruiting our students, and one of the things that they use as a recruitment mechanism is paying back those student loans in exchange for staying in their community for, you know, X amount of years. So there is a real interest in practicing rural, especially if you like that small town feel, knowing your patients, wanting to be really engaged in your community. We approach it as mission driven. You know, it's not for everybody, but we really talk about the need and the desire to serve a rural community needs to be there. And we have a lot of interest in really amazing students that want to do that.
And Vicki, I want to talk a little bit about Medicaid for people who may not be aware. This is the federal state health insurance program for people who are primarily low income with disabilities as well. What role does Medicaid especially play in people being able to access healthcare in rural areas?
Well, it's a huge driver. What we the research would tell us is that our rural areas tend to have more people on Medicaid than our urban or suburban areas. So it is a big payer source in terms of rural health care, and it allows our rural people to seek that care locally. So if the hospital or the primary care physicians are not there and do not or do not accept Medicaid, that also drives the patient to having to see somebody in an urban or suburban area.
And given that Medicaid and Medicare cuts are on the horizon, but they don't take effect for a year or two, why do they still affect hospitals today?
Well, it's coming down the pike, and there is a preparation that needs to take place. Part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is that there's also this Rural Health Transformation Fund that is coming out of that, which is an opportunity for states to receive some funding back. It doesn't make up for the cuts that they're anticipating, but it is an opportunity to put forth an application, and that application is actually due the end of December. So it's a quick turnaround, but it provides an opportunity for states to really look at how they can use this funding to address some of the deficits that they feel that may be coming through those Medicaid cuts.
I appreciate you bringing that up, Vicki. I'd like to, at this time, bring in my other guests, Vicki Weidenbacher-Hooper, Associate Director of Rural Health Workforce and Center Development. And I'm also joined today by Ted Rogalski, an administrator for two rural hospitals, one in Illinois and one in Iowa, Tracy Warner, Executive Director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network, and Melanie Evans, reporter and producer for the nonprofit news organization Tradeoffs. We have a caller on the line. Bruce in Freeport has a question about some of the stressors rural hospitals are facing. Bruce, go ahead.
Good morning. Ted, especially this might be something you identify with if you agree that hospitals, especially rural hospitals, have been stressed financially for many years. And so much of that is just their basic finances, is that Medicaid only pays pennies on the dollar of the cost of treatment. Medicare, in a good day, may pay 40% on the cost of a dollar for treatment, and the rest was made up of private insurance. So as you have rural areas where more people maybe become impoverished that are on Medicaid, that puts more stress on. As the population ages, which it is, obviously, especially in rural areas compared to urban, you have more of that underpayment, and sometimes there's less jobs that are on private insurance. So you end up with very little of that added overage that would pay. Thus, what it puts hospitals in is because they cannot turn away a patient, that they're either forced to certainly accept the Medicaid, but also their charitable write-offs have to go up, and all that stresses out everything against higher meds, higher operating costs, higher cost of maintaining staff and everything. So I don't see where this is going in a good direction. So certainly the Big Beautiful Bill is not going to help. I wondered what you thought of where that is going.
Thanks so much for your question, Bruce. Ted Rogalski, you're a hospital administrator for two rural hospitals. Go ahead. How would you respond to what Bruce just shared there?
Bruce, you bring up a lot of the economic challenges that we face. You know, in our rural areas, you can see anywhere from 60% to 80% of our revenue is government payment, as you pointed out. Now, I do want to clarify one thing. Most of our rural facilities are what's known as critical access hospitals. So Medicare does pay us better than what they would pay the urban hospital. So we get what they call cost reimbursement. So basically we break even on our Medicare patients. But you bring up a critical issue, and Medicaid was a lower payer. The provider tax assessment helped get that payment up instead of 60 cents on the dollar, more like 80 cents on the dollar. But we have to really focus in on that commercial patient population. That's how we can achieve financial success. So it's incumbent on us as providers to make sure we're providing the highest quality care, you know, and that we're having high patient satisfaction so we can maintain, you know, the patients in those communities that we serve. But that's how we can succeed financially. And the other thing that we've been looking at, you know, as far as my organizations, is growth. You know, what can we do to keep people to get their care there locally? So growth and focused in on commercial payments, that's the key to financial success. But it is a challenge, you're right.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Ted. And Melanie, I want to go to you next. Melanie is a reporter and producer with Trade-Offs. And, you know, Vicki mentioned there's a provision for healthcare relief funding in this legislation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's all about? And what difference do you expect that could make for rural hospitals that may get pushed to the brink of either reducing services or even having to close as a result of the upcoming changes?
Absolutely. So Congress was concerned about the finances of rural hospitals. And what they did is they included in this bill about $50 billion for rural transformation. As Vicki pointed out, $50 billion sounds like a lot, but it does not cover the projected financial hit to rural communities. The nonprofit health policy organization KFF projects that rural communities will see a loss of about $137 billion. Hmm. So $50 billion doesn't cover it. There are also some pretty big questions about how that $50 billion gets handed out. About half of it gets distributed equally among states with approved applications. KFF points out that those applications are kind of a gray area. And then the other half gets awarded in a way where federal officials and states kind of have to consider some criteria, but not all of them, and there's quite a bit of discretion. So there's a little bit of confusion, and at least among the people I've talked to, some anxiety about where that money's gonna go and how it's gonna get spent. And as Vicki points out, the first applications are due pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. If you're just, and, oh.
Yeah, I will just say, mm-hmm. like, Illinois is one of the states that KFF projects will be hardest hit broadly by the changes to Medicaid spending. But then also in rural areas, KFF is estimating that the state will see a loss of Medicaid spending in rural communities of about $6.6 billion.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, and we're talking about rural hospitals in Illinois, from how they're doing right now to how cuts to Medicaid and Medicare in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will affect those hospitals in terms of the care they're able to offer. I want to share a listener text. This is from Amy in Wakanda. Amy writes, I hope rural folks are ready to drive twice as long to wait four times as long for doctors half as good, because that's what you get when you cut funding to federal programs that help pay for people's health care. People don't just magically become able to afford health insurance because you took Medicaid away. And Amy goes on to say they just continue going to the hospital, but now they can't pay their medical bills, or they don't go to the hospital until their conditions are terrible, and then they don't pay their bills, and then hospitals don't pay doctors and nurses well, and then some quit or leave, and then the remaining ones get overworked, and then the competent ones quit the awful conditions. Amy, thank you for writing in to share your thoughts. Listeners, you can join the conversation 800-222-9455. Tracy, I wanted to just, you know, kind of give you a chance to speak here and ask your thoughts on what we've been talking about lately. Also, you know, we heard mentioned that there are 9 hospitals in Illinois that were potentially at risk of closing due to the Big Beautiful Bill. Your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, just a couple of comments to follow up on. I believe it was Bruce that was talking about the basic finances and how Ted responded to that.
Yes.
Completely agree about the process of how there is some shift in what we receive from different payers for the services provided. As Ted mentioned, that a lot of our rural hospitals are paid differently by Medicare, which allows them to receive payments that are closer to their cost. And then the commercial insurance patients and those payments try to make up for some of the differences in the shortfalls from the governmental payers. But one of the things that I would especially point out is that there are commercial insurance plans that administer the Medicare program now through Medicare Advantage, which is the private version of Medicare, if you will, that patients make a decision to have that Medicare Advantage coverage. And that payment rate from those commercial payers is not adequate and does not meet the regular Medicare payment level. So we're struggling even more with the fact that there are commercial insurance companies that are administering the Medicare program and Medicare Advantage. And just a call out to folks that are eligible for Medicare to really take a close look at what those companies offer in terms of the benefits at their local hospitals and at their local providers. But the other thing I would also say is that Medicare Advantage plans, as well as even Medicaid, the many administrative functions that we have to go through at a hospital have increased dramatically over the years, which is causing a lot of increase in cost and slowdown in payments as well. So there's a lot of administrative function there that will impact hospitals when you talk about the fact that some of these provisions and the cuts are farther out, but we're going to have to put processes in place to make sure that we're able to adequately perform those administrative functions, which is taking more and more resources and longer to get paid. Certainly agree with that texter on the kind of the vast, circling the drain, as it sounds like. But I will also point out that hospitals really do have the opportunity to look at different ways of providing care and to transform, like I said before, using technology, using AI, partnering within their communities or with other providers to provide care. Some of the funds that are in that Rural Health Transformation Act may allow some of these types of transformation opportunities to come forward that we haven't had in place before. So I would also like to address the number of Illinois hospitals that were on that at-risk hospital closure list. And the comment that was made by the hospital administrator earlier about not closing. Obviously, they're working their hardest to ensure that they're evolving and transforming to meet the needs of their communities under the challenges and constraints that we do have. So putting some a list out there of hospitals that are at risk of closing has been somewhat challenging to manage, because we don't want people to think that their hospital is closing and then leave the community for care, which further exacerbates the situation. And I would also point out that that list of hospitals that was produced and identified the 9 Illinois hospitals by name, some of that was related to the percentage of Medicaid patients that those hospitals see in comparison to national. So most of it was related to the volume of Medicaid as opposed to the finances of those individual hospitals.
And related to that list of hospitals that could potentially be at risk here, Brandy texted us to say, you know, I read that list. I saw maybe 6 of those are downstate hospitals. And Brandy in Urbana says, my family is from Decatur, Illinois, and they've seen a significant decline in access to medical care in town. They used to have 2 fully operational hospitals with specialists and all. And now they're lucky if they don't have to go to Springfield to receive care. Listeners, we'll be on this topic to the top of the hour. Our number to join our conversation is 800-222-9455 if you have questions or thoughts on the state of rural hospitals in Illinois. We're coming up on a short break, but when we come back, we're going to take a look ahead and talk about how rural hospitals are planning for the future in all of this. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman. We've been talking for the hour about rural hospitals, how they've been doing, how changes to Medicaid and Medicare affect them. And in this last part of the show, we'll try to make more sense of what comes next. Karen in Champaign texted us to say, yes, small hospitals will be the first to close, but it won't end there. Health insurance companies will have to take up covering the costs that Medicare and Medicaid used to cover, and they won't be able to. First, health insurance costs will go up. Eventually, health insurance companies will go under. Then hospitals will not be paid. And she goes on to say it would be more efficient and less wasteful if we figure this out before hospitals close and the buildings sit there empty and the medical staff are sent away, because building all that infrastructure back up will be much more expensive in the long run. Karen, thank you for that text. I'd like to reintroduce my guest. Vicki Weidenbacher-Hooper is with the National Center for Rural Health Professions. Tracy Warner is the executive director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. Melanie Evans, reporter and producer for the nonprofit news organization Tradeoffs, and Ted Rogalski, administrator for two rural hospitals, one in Illinois and one in Iowa. We've got another 10 minutes or so with this conversation, and you can join us at 800-222-9455. Tracy, right before the break, you mentioned creative solutions that rural hospitals need to consider, or perhaps are already starting to consider, pertaining to telehealth, even artificial intelligence. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of conversations that that hospital leaders are having today and what's happening on the ground right now to prepare and kind of pivot going forward.
Oh, certainly. Looking at the things that you had mentioned, telehealth really took flight during COVID, so that we had access, remote access to healthcare services. But you know, as you talk about the introduction of artificial intelligence in healthcare, there are a number of ways that that can be a tool, a technological tool to support healthcare. We've got some hospital physicians that are using it to more like ambient listening to help them do their notes afterwards, which considerably cuts down on the amount of time that they spend doing their notes and documentation of a visit, which increases their satisfaction, as you can imagine, because they are on task to see patients and interact with patients more than do paperwork. Same types of things happening, you know, with some of the nursing care of what tasks can be automated so that our healthcare professionals are taking care of patients, or in the case of nurses, their bedside next to their patients, giving that care and that administrative work, like some of the remote telemetry monitoring, and that technology can be done for several hospitals as opposed to having an individual at one hospital monitoring a fewer number of a patient. So a couple of things there that I think about, but also on the administrative side, certainly things that are being done to automate some of the routine tasks. As I mentioned, some of the appeals and denials and some of the administrative process that goes along with working with health insurance companies, some of that can be automated. I want to be clear in saying, though, that AI is a tool. It doesn't replace a person, but it does help to automate that process or some processes so that you get more of the interaction between a provider and a patient and the routine tasks that can be done through that AI or ambient listening or some sort of technology.
And to that point you raised, Tracy, you know, just regarding concerns about AI and what that means for jobs, Vicki, as someone who focuses on the rural healthcare workforce, what are your thoughts on this? And, you know, and any additional thoughts to share about the kinds of fundamental shifts and how rural hospitals operate in the years to come and how folks in the workforce will be adapting to those changes?
Yeah, great. Thank you. We've actually started including AI in our medical school curriculum to get students exposed to that earlier and comfortable using that, as well as telehealth. I think in terms of our rural health workforce, we've always been innovative, and I think that that will continue during this time as well. For our students, we rely heavily on our rural hospitals and rural primary care physicians across the state with over 70 plus partners that help educate our students. So we rely on them to bring our students into their rural community and show them how rural healthcare works. They are more than generous in doing that. We're always here to support them, and just hoping that with some of these new constraints that that doesn't play into maybe they're not able to take a student at this point in time because of the other burdens that they're experiencing. But they've always, our rural healthcare providers have always risen to the occasion, and we think that this will be no different.
And Ted, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you're preparing your rural hospitals for the upcoming changes, whether it involves looking to technology or other creative solutions. And what kinds of conversations are you having with other hospital administrators in rural parts of the state about how they're preparing as well?
Yeah, I think Tracy hit on, a lot of the impacts that AI and telehealth can bring to us, specifically in our institutions. You know, we can't get specialists to come out to our rural facilities, so we're connecting our patients with those specialists via telehealth. So pulmonology specialist in particular, in our emergency department, we can, if a patient comes in with a stroke, and I think a gentleman earlier brought that up, we can bring in a neurosurgeon to help guide our ED provider to deliver the best care until they can get to that higher level of care. So those are the things that we're seeing on a day-to-day basis. And I did want to piggyback a little bit on what Vicki was talking about workforce. Yes, AI is going to help us be more efficient from an administrative standpoint, but we still have major shortfalls in our workforce, not only from a nursing perspective, but from a physician perspective. That is not going to improve probably in any time in my career. So the more that we can do to, help them see more patients during a day, that's going to help us in the long run.
And Melanie Evans, reporter and producer with Trade-Offs, as you're listening to, our other guests share these ideas and these thoughts on how they're adapting, what are your thoughts on, and what are you hearing from other rural hospitals across the U.S.? Is this kind of similar to how other hospitals are adapting given the changing landscape of rural healthcare and the latest policy developments?
Well, I think Ted, Tracy, and Vicki are probably much more immersed in the conversations around some of these technologies. The conversations that I've had around how the new reconciliation package will affect hospital finances, they've really been about, they've been questions about how to make sort of corresponding cuts to hospital expenses, mm-hmm. or whether or not they need to look to a larger partner for an acquisition. And so a lot of what I've been hearing has been trying to sort of work through in the time that they have, like, what will this mean for the money they have to operate? How do they try to mitigate that, either working with their state legislature or making changes to their budget, or do they look to a larger acquirer? And there the question really becomes, and maybe Ted can speak to this, the question becomes, if they do seek a larger partner, they typically lose control over some of the really big decisions, but they potentially gain access to capital that can help them continue to invest during sort of financial times of financial stress and recruit, the staff that they need. And so maybe Ted can speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, I'd love to hear Ted's thoughts. And let me take a moment on tomorrow's show. We're going to be talking about private equity and speaking with a journalist whose new book kind of digs into the role of private equity in acquiring companies, businesses, and including hospitals that are struggling, and some of the shifts and developments that can come along with that, including sometimes closure. But Ted, I would love to hear your thoughts on what Melanie just shared. Is that in the cards for your hospitals in Northern Illinois and in Iowa?
You know, I think we will continue to see, rural facilities integrate into larger organizations. At the outset of our conversation today, I told you about Mercer County Hospital. So it's now Mercy One Genesis Aledo, was in that situation 13 years ago. That facility would be closed today had it not been for that integration into a larger health system. And Melanie kind of pointed out all the benefits of it, but really it allows us to operate more efficiently. You don't have that duplication of administrative services because that's done at the system level. So you can provide, you know, a lower cost of care overall because you're reducing that administrative burden. And I think we will continue to see that. We've seen it over the last decade where more and more rural facilities are joining larger health systems for that financial stability. And Melody pointed out another critical piece is that access to capital. That was a big thing. When we became part of the Aledo organization, we invested $12 million to bring that organization up to today's standards from a building standpoint and really focused in on our outpatient services and investing there.
And I'd like to go back to Melanie. I know you had some additional thoughts you wanted to share, and we just have a couple minutes left, so we'll have to round out the conversation here with you, Melanie. But your final thoughts, and also, you know, I'm curious to hear what kinds of things you'll be paying attention to going forward as you are reporting on these issues related to rural hospitals.
Yeah, Ted made great points about the capital available. There's also been like a lot of academic interest in this question of like what happens when a rural hospital is acquired. And they do find, you know, a couple of recent studies found, for example, operating margins increased, but there was a change in the makeup of the types of services they offered. And so less diagnostic imaging, less obstetrics. And so it can sometimes, some of that reconfiguration that a large system may sort of undertake can kind of like shift what's available locally. The other thing that I have followed for a number of years is what happens after mergers to prices. And that can sometimes be, the research really sort of points to mergers where you've got two nearby competitors who then become part of the common owner. And in those cases where you've got sort of a consolidation in an area, you can see prices rise. And so those will be some of the things that I'll be looking at. Like, are there closures? Is there consolidation? What does it mean for patient access and the cost of care?
And we'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you so much to my guests for joining us today. Melanie Evans is a reporter and producer with Trade-Offs. Ted Rogalski is a hospital administrator with Mercy One Genesis Aledo Medical Center and Mercy One Genesis DeWitt Medical Center. Vicki Weidenbacher-Hooper is with the National Center for Rural Health Professions at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Rockford, and Tracy Warner with the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. Thank you, all of you, for sharing your expertise and insights with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, as I mentioned, private equity companies are not household names to most Americans, but they touch so many facets of our lives, from housing to newspapers and even to rural hospitals. Journalist Megan Greenwell writes about what that means for our economy and the people working on the front lines of it in her new book, Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. We'll talk with her about it next time on the 21st Show. Before we go, please consider joining our texting group. It's the most popular way for listeners to share comments and questions on the show. Just text the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or topics. Email us, talk@21stshow.org. You can find that address and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, on our website, which is 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all our past shows up on that website. You can find links to subscribe to our podcast. You can look us up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And we're also now on YouTube. Just search for the Illinois Public Media page. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Layli Nazarova is an associate producer. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey this week. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow.